Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And every couple of years, most of you go to the polls and cast a ballot for the people you want to represent you in government. But otherwise, how involved are you in making decisions about how we govern? When law professor Beth Novak went to work at the White House in 2009, she had a vision for making government less of a bureaucratic monolith that's literally hidden behind bomb blast curtains and making the government more open. She thought that by experimenting with new technology, we could get everyday experts involved in shaping our policies. Turns out that wasn't easy. Beth Novak is a professor at NYU's School of Engineering, the former Deputy Chief Technology Officer for the Obama administration, and now the author of Smart Citizens, Smarter State, published by the Harvard University Press. Beth, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Good to be here.
To make this concrete for people from the start, what's a good example of how governments are already using technology to include people with certain areas of expertise who otherwise might not be civic-minded? You have a host of them in your book. Start out with one great example.
So one great example is that over the last 5 years, the federal government in Washington launched a website called challenge.gov. This went beyond the usual practice of just asking people how they feel, doing opinion polling, asking us for our views on a policy, to actually asking people to get involved in solving problems. On challenge.gov, federal agencies post hard problems. If you go there now, you can find, for example, a challenge backed by a very large prize. If you can help the government solve the problem of reducing the amount of salt water that could aid in better agriculture and development and farming. You can go on there now and if you lend your expertise to solving the problem of how to reduce the word gap between the number of words that a rich kid and a poor kid hear before the time that they're 5 years old. So this goes beyond what we've seen before, which is just asking us what we feel, to really asking us what we know and reaching out to people to lend their expertise.
And people showed up for those linguistic and agricultural examples?
There have been 450 different challenges with different kinds of prizes that range from multi-millions of dollars to the chance to shake the president's hand or simply put the participation in the challenge on your resume. But what these are opportunities for people to get involved according to what they know best, what they can do, what they're passionate about, what they care about. It's a real departure from the vision that participation is something we do only once a year or once every 4 years, and a participation that's really one size fits all, where we're just voting for a candidate who then leads us while we sit back passively and watch.
You give the great example of a San Francisco suburb that uses a smartphone app to actually text people with CPR training who happen to be near a victim who called 911. How does that work?
Yeah, so it's quite amazing. It's part of the movement, the larger and broader phenomenon of governments making data available, in this case, the data feed of 911 data. And with that, this app called PulsePoint, created by the Fire Department of San Ramon, California, but now available across about 1,400 different communities, is able to geolocate where someone is having a heart attack and where you, if you're a registered participant, are located. The faster that you can get to the aid and to the side of that person having a heart attack, the faster bystander CPR can be performed, the greater the likelihood, double, triple the likelihood the person will survive. Over the last 5 years, they've activated the app to save lives in over 7,000 different contexts. So it's really concrete. But the difference between that one, between PulsePoint and challenge.gov, is challenge.gov is still relying on the open call. Hey, anyone out there who's smart, anyone out there who can know and can help us. PulsePoint takes it to the next step, which is to register people with a specific skill, namely having CPR ability, the ability to use a defibrillator, and is then able to match them, to match the demand for expertise, CPR, to the supply of it in local communities to solve a really hard problem, which is to save lives.
You wrote an op-ed in The Guardian titled, "Swipe Right to Fix the World. Can Tinder-like tech match solutions to problems?" What can the government learn from Tinder?
Well, hopefully, first of all, that we can make civic engagement a little more fun and not quite so serious as the way that we've typically thought about it. But there's a broader context here. Whether it's for dating or whether it's for jobs, what apps like Tinder are really good at is matching us, right? They connect us based on our passions, based on our preferences, based on, well, other criteria. But in the job context, more seriously, we're seeing lots of efforts now to use new data-driven tools to match the skills that I have to available job opportunities. We have foundations like Lumina. They're putting money back of this the Chamber of Commerce Foundation also that's investing in creating new platforms to match job seekers to available jobs. So we need to do some of the same thing for government. If we actually want to connect people based on what they know to opportunities to serve. So if we want to find the teachers who can help with that word gap challenge, or we want to find the farmers who can help with that challenge to reduce salt water, we can use some of these new Tinder-like tools, in other words, these data-driven tools that allow government to search for what people know and can do and to match them to opportunities to serve.
My guest is Beth Novak, who was President Obama's first Deputy Chief Technology Officer, and she's an NYU professor at the School of Engineering, now the author of Smart Citizens, Smarter State. And let me look back to President Obama's first day in office in 2009. He signed a memorandum on transparency and open government, which was designed to increase public participation in his administration in just the ways you've been describing. But plenty of people will tell you that transparency has not been the hallmark of the Obama years. What went wrong?
Well, it's what hasn't gone right yet. And I think that's the reason that I wrote this book, is precisely because we came in with so much hope that we were going to radically transform how government worked. We're going to change the relationship between citizen and the state, increase trust between citizens and those who govern them by giving everybody a chance to get more involved using new technology. So we're seeing lots of examples of this, both in government and in civic life, right, where we're using what's often called crowdsourcing, you know, tech-enabled engagement to get people involved in solving hard problems. Challenge.gov is only one example, right? We're seeing lots of these cases where so-called citizen scientists are going out there, measuring their air quality, measuring their water quality. Cornell has a great project called Yard Map, where they're getting you to map your backyard and track habitats of birds, which are helping, again, to solve public problems. But the question is, why hasn't it transformed how we govern? Why does government today really look not radically different than it did 5 years ago? And the answer I'm put forward in the book, and that has occurred to me in looking at this issue over the last few years, is that crowdsourcing by itself is not going to be enough to transform our institutions. We cannot rely on the fact that we put out an open call, even backed by a prize with a lot of money. It's not going to get the right eyeballs on the problem. So part of the way we're going to solve that is by using some of these new tools, which have only just emerged, which are sometimes called expert networks, skill finders, talent platforms, talent finders. They come by a lot of different names. But essentially, they are these matching platforms that can do a better job of essentially greasing the skids to allow me, as somebody who cares about a certain set of issues, who has know-how in a particular set of domains, to be able to find those opportunities that target what I know and can do. It's going to also increase the likelihood that I want to participate and help.
We just have a few minutes, but I wonder if anybody listening now has ever participated in one of these ad hoc expert networks. Call in and share your experience with Beth Novak, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or you can ask a quick question. So you were a law professor. Now you're an engineering professor. Interesting combination to begin with. And you're a writer who thinks a lot about how government could run differently. What did you learn by actually jumping into it? What surprised you from your time with the White House?
Well, first of all, it's, I think, anybody who has the chance to do public service by working in government, it's a great honor to be able to serve. But I think importantly, especially for somebody who writes about these issues, is the chance to see in practice how they actually work. Most people who work in government are incredibly dedicated. They are honest, they are hardworking, and they are they take very seriously their responsibility to the taxpayer to do a very good job. But the challenge is, no matter how smart you are and how well-intentioned you are, it is very hard to get the expertise that you need quickly to do your job. So I'll give you an example, both from myself but also from the people who've worked with me. I had a student who came after a stint in the White House who came to work at the GovLab at NYU with me. He was 24 years old, and he had just come from a fabulous job where he was tasked with crafting the nation's small business policy. He had never owned a business. Hmm. He had never run a business. He'd never worked in a business. I had another young man who had worked for the Senate. He was in charge of writing a piece of legislation on LGBT youth homelessness. He had a roof over his head. So it's not, though they had tremendous credentialed expertise and access to the best think tanks in Washington, often what you need to know, whether it's in Washington or in Albany or in New York City, is you need people with the know-how, with the skills, with the diverse experience and background that you need to craft really good policies and to solve hard problems. And what I got to see firsthand from being in Washington is how many issues you have to work on, how little time you have, how much expertise you require, and how desperate the need is for using new tools to get at that know-how faster.
Sally in Inwood, you're on WNYC with Beth Novick. Hi, Sally.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call, Brian. I just had a quick question, like bringing it down to a city level. We have participatory budgeting in my council district we're in, I guess, year two, and we have a mayor that promised transparency who apparently, with Freedom of Information at least, I think they are now reviewing every, I guess, sensitive Freedom of Information request. My question, I guess, is we have all this expertise in our communities, and how do we make sure, I mean, we have people like Gail Brewer, who is the data queen. I mean, she wants to make everything available, and the issue is getting city agencies to comply with giving the data that we need to help them make decisions,
right.
Like Parks Department. They're the stewards of our public land. How can we, who spend our days in the parks, get our expertise quickly through them so that the funding might be available? Right now, we're dependent on places like Citizens Committee of NYC through the Parks and Catalyst Program, et cetera.
Sally, thank you. And Gail Brewer, who she mentions, is the Manhattan Borough President. I think there are really two questions in that. And one is, you're a New Yorker, as well as having worked in the federal administration. New York City has app development contests and things like that. Is New York particularly good at this, or middle of the pack, or is no government really good at this, and you're just waiting for somebody to really implement this vision you have?
So I think she pointed to, the listener pointed to one thing that we have been really good at, and Gail Brewer has really been the champion of helping to make data more available. And New York City is in the forefront of a lot of cities now, as well as at the federal government, of making data sets more available. And that's great, and you see cities, not New York, but I might mention Chicago, which recently just launched a program to start using more locally available data to do things like better inspect restaurants, something we care about a lot here. Chicago has 16,000 restaurants. They have 36 inspectors who, in, you know, the way they used to do things was to go down a list, inspecting restaurant by restaurant by restaurant, and then you, if you were lucky, you would catch the offenders and the violators before they made more people sick. Using data, they were able to change how they did that to prioritize, to create an algorithm to prioritize the restaurants that were most at risk. But that data isn't enough. The point is that we need to be able to do things like tap into human intelligence and expertise. So in Europe, the European Food Safety Administration is realizing they don't have the best scientific expertise as a couple of dozen people trying to advise the European Commission about food safety. And they're moving to become a totally open agency. And they have just put out a call to ask, how do we use technology? How do we crowdsource better expertise? The answer is we're just at the beginning of this. No government is doing it very well yet, but we're seeing pockets in places that give us the hope that this can become possible.
And the reason I said Sally's call seemed to raise two issues is there a difference between, participatory government, which is part of what you're calling for here, getting people with all kinds of expertise to be welcomed in as lay people and help form good policy and good solutions, and transparency in government, which is more letting the public know what you're doing so that we know how our tax dollars are being spent and that kind of thing. Are they two sides of the same coin, or these are really two different topics?
They are related, but they are two different topics in the following sense, that one of the one purpose of transparency is to shine a light, to open a window into how government is working, how it spends our taxpayer dollars, what it does. In many contexts, that's about decreasing corruption and increasing efficiency and effectiveness. But even without advances in transparency, we can do a lot to become more participatory as a way to solve problems more effectively. So separate from the issue of scrutinizing how government operates, we have, as you pointed out, issues about how we spend money through the, and that's where participatory budgeting comes in, how we run our parks, how we inspect our restaurants, how we put in bike lanes, how we take out the trash, all the many problems that we confront in a city or at the national level. That citizens can help us to solve better and more effectively if we can develop institutions that are a little bit more agile at welcoming in and knowing how to use that kind of expertise. We're seeing the beginnings of it, But the technology that's available to us today through expert networks, things like a LinkedIn that allow us to make more searchable what people know and can do, can help us to do a little bit better job of finding the people with the expertise that we need at the time we need it.
A vision of the future, increasingly part of the present. Beth Novak, NYU professor, now the author of Smart Citizens, Smarter State, after trying to implement some of these things in the Obama administration. Thank you so much.
Thank you.